put it on and pull the cowl right down over your face, there are eye holes in it, and walk boldly upstairs to the first floor and give 5 knocks on the drawing room door. When the door is opened, say in the name of the Council of 7, peace be unto you, and walk right in and up to me, I shall be cowled the same as you, but you will know me because my robe is also scarlet. I shall be on a dais at the end of the room. When you get up to me, I shall rise, and we will shake hands, and then you will take my chair, and I shall sit at your right. You will stretch out your hand and say, I come in the name of the great chiefs. Then we will proceed to business. You will answer yes or no to any question you are asked, but nothing more. And if you fail and he pushed his ugly face right into mine, you will have to reckon with the unseen forces which you have invoked. Is that clear? Perfectly clear, I said, only I am not sure that I can remember it all, and how am I to know whether to answer yes or no? You will watch me out of the corner of your eye. If I stir my right foot, you will answer yes. If I stir my left, you will answer no. I shan't move em much, so you must keep a sharp lookout. And when I fold my hands you must stand up, say it is finished, and walk out. Come down here and clear out the way you came, being careful to see that the red robe is well hidden under the cushions, the bars replaced, and the coal cellar door shut. When Josephus finished he looked me straight in the eyes with a very steady gaze, which I returned equally steadily. I allowed a moment to elapse before I replied, for I did not want to appear to accept with too great alacrity. I'll take it on, I said. A gleam of satisfaction lit up Josephus' curious eyes. He looked very much like a jackdaw who has secreted some bauble. We parted the best of friends, and I returned to Harley Street, where Taverner, having finished the day's interviews, was awaiting me. I recounted the conversation that had taken place, and Taverner was immensely intrigued. That tells me a great many things, he said. I agree with you that Josephus is not a trained occultist, but he knows a great deal about the secret side of both sex and drugs, and he is a very clever manipulator of human nature and loves intrigue for its own sake, as this scheme of his shows. What do you make of it? I said. What is he driving at? I should say that his group was getting restless, said Taverner. He evidently does not take them into his confidence, vide the window bars. You are apparently designed to appear as some messenger of higher powers whom he has invoked in support of his authority. This leads me to believe that he is conducting a one-man show, and this taken in conjunction with what we suppose to be his ignorance of ritual magic, makes me think that he never has been initiated into any fraternity. But, my God, if he had been, what wouldn't he have done if he had had a knowledge of the names of power in addition to his natural gifts? The fraternities are well guarded, Rhodes. We don't often have a traitor. Now come along, we have just got nice time for a meal before the evening's entertainment. We went to the restaurant in Soho where the metaphysical head waiter, who appeared to be interested in the same subjects as Taverner, held sway. Of course we had our usual warm but respectful welcome and were led to a retired table, and as the metaphysician hovered round us with the wine list, Taverner beckoned him nearer and said, Giuseppe, we are going this evening to number 7, Malvern Square, near Cower Street. It is a back entrance into the alley behind, and the bars of a window looking into the backyard can be removed by pressing them down. Ring me up at Harley Street at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, and if I am not back, take steps in the matter. You know what to do. As soon as we were alone, Taverner produced a small silver pocket flash and a pad of gauze, which he passed to me under cover of the tablecloth. That's chloroform, he said. Have the pad ready and clap it over his nose as soon as he opens the door. I have got a length of cord in my pocket. Josephus is not going to appear in this act. But what am I going to do when I am sitting in the seats of the mighty and Josephus isn't there to twiddly his toes when they ask awkward questions? I said anxiously. Wait and see, said Taverner. I noticed that beside his chair was a small suitcase. We timed our arrival in the back alley just nicely, and I heard a crunching of the coals that betokened Josephus' advent, just as I was putting the chloroform onto the pad. No, whispered Taverner, and I knocked softly on the grimy door. It opened an inch. That you, Rhodes? Whispered a voice from the darkness. Come in quietly. They're all about, damn them. Fussing with the supper things. Why can't women leave things alone? The voice sounded bad-tempered. Where are you, old chap? I said, feeling for him in the darkness. My hand touched his throat and instantly closed on it. I clapped the pad over his face and thrust him backward with my whole strength. Down he went on to the coals with me on top of him. He was a powerful man and struggled like a cat, but I was much the bigger, and he hadn't a chance. His struggles slackened as the chloroform got in its work, and when Taverner, who had been securing the door, flashed a hooded torch upon us, I was kneeling on his inanimate form. Taverner tied him up with an expertness which indicated experience, and then cast about for somewhere to conceal him. I don't want him discovered prematurely, if anyone should want a scuttle of cools, he said. Why not dig a hole and bury him? I suggested, having thoroughly entered into the spirit of the place. Here's a shovel. Make a hole and stick him in up to the neck, and put that old bottomless bucket over his head. Taverner chuckled, and in 2 minutes Josephus was as if he had never been, and leaving him thus very indecently interred, we made our way cautiously into the yard. It was pitch black, but my knowledge of the geography of the place enabled me to find the window, and in less time than it takes to tell, we had dislodged the bars, got in, switched on the light, and locked the door on the inside. Here's your garment, said Taverner, pulling a flowing scarlet robe from under the sofa cushions and inducting me into it with a knowledge of its anatomy which pointed to previous experience. There was a soft knock at the door and I held my breath. Are you ready, dearest? They are all assembled, said a feminine voice. Go on in and begin, snarled Taverner, in a voice so exactly like Josephus that I involuntarily looked over my shoulder. We heard the footsteps die away down the passage, evidently Josephus had taught them not to argue, and in a few minutes the sound of chanting broke out overhead. Taverner opened his suitcase and took out the most wonderful robes I have ever seen in my life. Stiff with embroidery and heavy with bullion, the great cope looked like the mines of Ophir in the shaded light of that somber room. Taverner put it on over an emerald green soutane and I fastened the jeweled clasp upon his breast. Then he handed to me, for he could not raise his arms, the headdress of Egypt, and I placed it on his head. I have never seen such a sight. The gaunt lineaments of Taverner framed in the Egyptian drapery, his tall figure made gigantic by the cope, and the jeweled ankh in his hand, which I was thankful to see was sufficiently heavy to be effective as a weapon, made a picture which I shall remember to my dying day. Every time he moved, the incense of many rituals floated from the folds of his garments, the silk rustled, the gold work clinked, it seemed as if a priest-king of lost Atlantis had come, in response to an invocation, to claim the obedience of his worshippers. We went up the narrow stairs into the darkened hall, and thence to the drawing-room floor, where a smell of incense told us that we were upon the right track. Taverner smote upon the door 5 times, and we heard a voice say, Guardian of the gate, see who seeks admission. The door opened, and we were confronted by a plump and dumpy figure robed and cowled in black, which nearly went over backwards at sight of Taverner. My scarlet robe evidently led the doorkeeper to mistake me for Josephus, for we were admitted without demur, and found ourselves in what was evidently the temple of the strange worship which he conducted. I made straight for the dais, as I had been instructed, and sat down before they could notice my height, and I am pretty certain that they all thought their usual magus was in the chair. Taverner, however, advanced to the altar, and extending the golden ankh towards the assembly, said in that resonant voice of his, Peace to all beings. This was evidently the opening they expected, for the figure on a raised dais at the far end of the room, which from its height I judged to be the tall woman, replied, From whom do you bring greeting? I do not bring it, said Taverner. I give it. This was evidently not the right cue, and threw the whole lodge into confusion, but so completely did Taverna dominate them, that it was they, not he, who did not know their part. All eyes turned to me, believing me to be Josephus, but I sat like a graven image and gave no sign. Then Taverna spoke again. The name of the Council of Seven has been invoked, and I who am the senior of seven, have come unto you. Know me by this sign, and he extended his hand. On the forefinger flashed a great ring. I don't believe anyone in the room was any the wiser, but the lodge officers, who were supposed to know, were ashamed to admit they didn't, and the rank and file naturally followed their lead. There was dead silence in the room, which was suddenly broken by a rustle of drapery as a figure upon a third dais on my left arose, and I heard the voice of Mary McDermott speaking. I ask pardon for my lack of faith, she said. It was I who invoked the Council of Seven because I believed them to be non-existent. But I realize my error. I see the power and I acknowledge it. Your face tells me of your greatness, the vibrations of your personality tell me of your truth and goodness. I recognize and I obey. Taverna turned towards her. How came it that you believed the Council of Seven to be non-existent? He demanded in that great resonant voice of his. Because my husband's importunities had come between me and my duty to the order. Because his prayers and invocations of the saints had spread like a cloud between me and the brightness of the Master's face, so that I could not see his glory, and believed him to be a vulgar sensualist and charlatan, taking advantage of our credulity. My daughter, said Taverna, and his voice was very gentle, do you believe in me? I do, she cried. I not only believe, I know. It is you I have seen in my dreams, you are the initiator I have always sought. The Master Josephus promised he would bring me to you, and he has kept his word. Approach the altar, commanded Taverna. She came and knelt before him unbidden. He touched her forehead with the golden ankh, and I saw her sway at the touch. From the unreal, lead me to the real. From darkness bring me to light. From impurity cleanse me and sanctify me, came the deep resonant voice. Then he took her by the hand and raised her, and placed her beside me on the dais. Taverna returned to the altar and took his stand before it and surveyed the room. Then from under his cope he produced a curiously wrought metal box. He opened one end and took out of it a handful of white powder and strewed it upon the altar in the form of a cross. Unclean, he said, and his voice was like the tolling of a bell. He opened the other end of the box and took out a handful of ashes, and these also he strewed upon the altar, defiling its white linen covering. Unclean, he said again. He stretched forth his ankh, and with the head of it extinguished the lamp that burnt upon the altar. Unclean, he said a third time, and as he did so, all sense of power seemed to leave the room, and it became flat, ordinary, and rather tawdry. Taverna alone seemed real, all the rest were make-believe. He seemed like a live man in a room full of waxworks. He turned, and I rose, and with the girl between us, we left the room in the midst of dead silence. I closed the door softly behind us, and, finding that the key was in the lock, took the precaution to turn it. In the darkened hall, unlit save for the rays of a street lamp through the fanlight, Taverna confronted the bewildered girl. She had pushed back her cowl, and her bright hair fell in disorder about her face. He placed his hands on her shoulder. My daughter, he said. You cannot advance save by the path of duty. You cannot rise to the high life on broken faith and neglected obligations. The man who has given his name and heart into your keeping cannot have a home unless you make him one, cannot have a child unless you give him one. You may free yourself from him, but he cannot free himself from you. In this incarnation you have elected to choose the path of the hearth fire, and therefore no other is open to you. Return, and see that the fire is lit and that hearth swept and garnished, and I will come to you and show you how illumination may be obtained upon that path. You have invoked the Council of Seven, and have therefore come under the discipline of the Council of Seven, and coming under the discipline, you have come under the protection. Depart in peace. And he opened the door and put her outside. We hastily collected our impedimenta and followed her. A violent ringing of electric bells in the basement showed that the people upstairs had discovered that they were locked in. The night drive down to Hindhead cleared my brain, which whirled strangely. A vision of Taverner in Copenhagen dress danced before my eyes, which the everyday appearance of my chief in frieze overcoat and muffler did nothing to allay. At length we reached our destination, put the car to bed, and stood for a moment under the tranquil stars before entering the silent house, long since wrapped in slumber, and as I thought of the events of the evening I seemed to move in a dream. Suddenly recollection hit me on the solar plexus and I woke with a start. Taverner. I said, supposing someone delivers a load of coals on top of Josephus? End of this story, and next is A Son of the Night. It was not often that people attempted to use Taverner for their own ends, and it was only because the Countess of Cullen was so sure of her powers that the attempt was made. She was a very great lady, though somewhat blown upon as to reputation. She had reason to believe in her power over men, and never doubted that Taverner and I, given sufficient encouragement, would worship at her well-served shrine. She was a neighbor of ours. The grounds of the nursing home, in fact, being carved out of the Cullen estate during the days when the old Earl was using capital as income. The present Earl was a man of a very different type, so different, in fact, from what might have been expected of a scion of the House of Cullen, that rumor had it that he was not quite all there. Be that as it may, he was at least there enough to keep a tight hand on the family finances and insisted on allowing the goose of capital to lay the golden eggs of interest instead of having it killed then and there to assuage the family hunger. This, rumor added, was a very sore point, and productive of much rancor in the home life. The opening move in the game took place when Taverner and I were invited to a garden party at Cullen Court, and needless to say, did not go. The next move was when the Countess drove over in her two-seater and insisted that I should return forthwith to make up a set at tennis. I was cornered and could not escape, and, having been assigned my flapper, duly patted balls over the net of the Honourable John, younger brother of the Earl, and his flapper, who returned them in a resigned kind of fashion, till we came to the conclusion that a single might not, after all, be without its charms. Deposited our flappers in the shade, and set to work in earnest. Having a long reach, a steady eye, and a good wind, I take kindly to games, though they are not my enthusiasm as they are with some people who are able to acquit themselves adequately. To the Honourable John, however, sport took the place of religion, and in whatever game he played he had to excel, and to give him his due, he generally succeeded in doing so. In the first set he beat me after a struggle, in the second set I beat him in a thrilling contest, and in the third we settled down to a life and death battle. All his debonair charm was gone, and the face that looked at me across the net was positively malignant as the score slowly turned against him. When the game concluded in my favor, it was all he could do to remember his manners. The cloud soon blew away, however, and after a pleasant tea on the terrace, the Countess drove me home again with her own fair hands. I had grown much more inclined to accept future invitations. But, although I was quite willing to play the Honourable John at tennis, I was distinctly anxious to steer clear of the Countess, for, though old enough to be my aunt, if not my mother, she blatantly flirted with me. A dinner party was arranged shortly after that. Taverner could not escape it, even with all his wiliness, and duly led in the Countess, who, to my intense amusement, flirted with him also. I had the very pretty daughter, who seemed to take after her mother in more than her looks, for my partner. But, while the mother appeared bent on making an impression on Taverner, the daughter seemed equally bent on making me realize that I had made an impression on her, and each glanced at the other occasionally to see how she was getting on. It gave me an odd and unpleasant feeling to see these two women of a great family making a dead set at a couple of commoners like Taverner and myself, and as I saw Taverner succumbing to the lure I got more and more disgusted, sulky, and silent with my companion until it struck me that there might be a method in Taverner's madness. He was, at the best of times, the least impressionable of men, and very unlikely to be attracted by this overblown rose of a woman who was wooing him so blatantly. So I in my turn allowed myself to succumb to the daughter, and received in exchange the confidence that there was a great sorrow in their lives, and that she herself was under the shadow of fear and felt dire need of the protection of a masculine arm. Did I ever ride out on the moors? She did, every morning, so perhaps some day we might meet, far from watching eyes, and then, perhaps, I might be able to help her with a little advice, for she felt the need of a man's advice. For nothing more than advice did she ask upon this occasion, and then she changed the subject. They disgusted me, these women. They were so blatant and sure of their power to charm. It also struck me as strange that the master of the house not only never appeared, but was never referred to. He might have been non-existent for all the part he played in this elaborate ménage, which seemed to be run by the mother for the exclusive benefit of herself and her two younger children. "Tavernor," I said as we drove away, "what do you suppose they want with us?" "They have not shown their hand yet," he answered, "but I do not fancy we shall be kept long in suspense. They are not exactly backward in coming forward." As we came out of the park gates, Tavernor suddenly swerved the car just in time to avoid someone who was entering, and I saw for a moment in the glare of the headlights a strange-looking face, high-cheekboned, hook-nosed, and haggard, with a rough crop of unkempt black hair surmounting it. The darkness swallowed him up and he vanished without a word spoken, yet he left upon me the impression that I had seen someone who mattered. I cannot express it more clearly than that nor give a reason for my feeling, yet he impressed me as being far more than a random pedestrian whom we had nearly run down. His face haunted me, I could not get it out of my mind. I had a curious feeling that I had seen it somewhere before, and then it suddenly came to me where I had seen it. In a neighboring village lived an old parson who had a very similar cast of countenance. Probably the stranger was a son, or even a grandson of his, but what was he doing, going hatless up to Cullen Court at that hour of the night? I could not imagine. I did not ride with that scion of nobility, the Lady Mary, but Tavernor hobnobbed shamelessly with her formidable parent. "I have had my instructions," he said, and no other explanation would he give. But for me nowadays no other explanation was needed, for I knew quite well that there were those under which Tavernor worked, just as I worked under him, though they were not of this plane of existence. I do not think that at the time Tavernor himself had any inkling of what was afoot. He merely knew that here was a matter in which those to whom he looked desired him to take a hand, and so he gave the Countess of Cullen opportunity to develop her intrigues in her own way, biding his time. The intrigue took longer than we expected to develop, and I began to suspect that the Countess was as anxious for its conclusion as we were. At last the opportunity for which she had been waiting arrived, and she phoned for us to come at once. Her eldest son, it seems, was having one of his attacks, and she wanted Tavernor to see him actually in the throes of it, and was therefore anxious for his speedy arrival lest the invalid should recover and cease to be interesting. She expressly desired that I should come too. The reason for this she would explain upon our arrival, as she did not care to confide it over the telephone. 10 minutes in the car brought us to Cullen Court, and we were shown forthwith into the boudoir of the Countess, a room as pink and overblown as she. In a few seconds she came in, clad in filmy black, followed by her daughter in virginal white. They made a lovely picture for those who like stage effects, but I am afraid I despised the two women too heartily to appreciate them. A minute later the Honorable John came in also, and supported by her family, the Countess opened her heart to us. "We have a great sorrow in our lives, Dr. Tavernor, upon which we want to ask your advice and help, and yours, too, Dr. Rhodes," she added, including me as an afterthought. I was of the opinion that exasperation rather than sorrow would best describe their condition, but I bowed politely and said nothing. "You are so sympathetic," she continued to my partner, my existence having once more slipped her memory. "You have such wonderful insight. I knew as soon as I met you that you would understand, and I was sure also," here she lowered her voice to a whisper, "that you would help." She laid her hand upon Tavernor's sleeve and gazed back. The Honorable John turned his back and looked out of the window, and I felt pretty certain that he shared with me an irresistible desire to burst out laughing. "It is my eldest son, poor Marius," continued the Countess. "I am afraid we have got to face the fact that he is quite insane." She paused, and dabbed her eyes. "We have delayed and delayed as long as ever we could, perhaps too long. Perhaps, if we had had him treated earlier we might have saved him. Don't you think so, John?"
"No, I don't," said John. "He has been mad as a March hare ever since I can remember, and ought to have been locked up before he got big enough to be dangerous."
"Yes, I am afraid we have not acted rightly by him," said the Countess, taking refuge in her handkerchief again. "We should have had him certified long ago."
"Certification is not a form of treatment," said Tavernier dryly. The Honorable John darted a somewhat unpleasant look at my colleague, opened his mouth as if to speak, thought better of it, and shut it again.
"The time has come," said the Countess, "when we have got to face it. I must part with my poor darling for the sake of my other children." We bowed sympathetically.
"Would you like to see him?" she asked.
We bowed again. Up the heavily carpeted stairs we went, and along a far wing to a bedroom which I should imagine the owner had occupied as a boy. We crossed the worn oilcloth on the floor, and saw before us, lying insensible upon a narrow iron bedstead, the man whom we had nearly run over at the park gates, and whom I had set down as the son or grandson of the old cleric in the neighboring village. Tavernier stood gazing down upon the unconscious form for some time without speaking, while the Countess and her son watched him closely and with increasing uneasiness as the moments lengthened out. At last he said, "I cannot certify a man because I find him unconscious."
"We can tell you all his symptoms, if that is what you want," said the Honorable John.
"Neither would that be enough," said Tavernier. "I must see for myself."
"Then you doubt our word?" said John, looking ugly.
"Not at all," said Tavernier, "but I must fulfill the requirements of the law and certify from observation, not hearsay." He turned suddenly to the Countess.
"Who is your usual medical man?" he demanded. She hesitated a moment.
"Dr. Parks," she said reluctantly. "What does he say about the case?"
"We are not satisfied with his treatment. We don't think he is sufficiently careful."
I thought to myself that Dr. Parks had probably also been asked to certify, and had also declined.
"If you want to see," said the Honorable John, "we can soon show you," and he dipped the fringe of a towel in the water jug, tore open the pajama jacket, and began to flick the chest of the unconscious man. His action revealed a body wasted to skeleton thinness on which angry red wheels sprang up at each blow of the knotted threads. The end of a fringed towel, weighted with water, is a cruel weapon, as I well knew from my school days, and it was all I could do to keep myself from interfering, but Tavernier remained mobile, watching, and I let myself be guided by his example. This drastic method of resuscitation soon produced twitchings of the unconscious form, and then spasmodic movements of the limbs, which finally coordinated themselves into definite attempts at self-defense. It was like the struggles of a sleeper fighting in nightmare, and when the eyes at last opened, they had the dazed, bewildered look of a man suddenly roused from deep sleep in strange surroundings. He plainly did not know where he was, neither did he recognize the people standing around him, and he was evidently prepared to resist to the limits of his strength all efforts to control him. Those limits were soon reached, however, and he lay immobile in the powerful hands of his brother, watching us with strange, filmy eyes and uttering neither word nor sound.
"You see for yourself," said John triumphantly. Lady Cullen dabbed her eyes with a wisp of a lace handkerchief.
"I am afraid it is hopeless," she said. "We cannot keep him at home any longer.
Where would you advise us to send him, Dr. Tavernier?"
"I would be prepared to take charge of him," said Tavernier, "if you would be willing to entrust him to me."
The Countess clasped her hands.
"Oh, what a relief," she cried. "What a blessed relief from the anxiety that has burdened us for so many years.
You will get the formalities through as soon as possible, won't you, Doctor?" said the Honorable John.
"There are a lot of business matters that want attending to, and we shall need your certificate in order to take them over." Taverner dry washed his hands and bowed unctuously. Two-Eye, meanwhile, had been watching the man on the bed, whom everyone else seemed to have forgotten. I could see that he was gathering together his scattered wits and was attuned to the position in which he found himself.